What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a beautiful Thursday afternoon. Sitting across from the beautiful Matt Odell, we're here for another edition of Rabbit Hole Recap. What's going on, Matt?
What's up, freaks?
Very vitriolic week on Twitter.
So much fucking drama.
A lot of drama.
So much salt. Is that time? Is that we're in our this time of the cycle, you know?
It's that time in the market cycle. We'll get into it. I got some comments. I'm not going to pour any gas on the fire or anything. Just some comments. Current price of Bitcoin, according to the TFTC.io ticker, is $7,200.95. The current block height is block 607,817. The current hash rate is 88.98 exahash per second, according to our node. Price has been in a bit of a rangy to downward motion the last week.
According to our node sees prices.
No, I was talking about the hash rate there.
Price has gone down a little bit since last time, I think.
Yeah, we got prices gone down. News, not too much Bitcoin news this week, but we do have a lot of stuff going on outside of the world of Bitcoin.
A lot of Twitter drama to cover.
A lot of Twitter drama, a lot of leaky software out there that people are bringing into their homes, and a bunch of other stuff. But before we get into that, we got to give a shout out to our sponsors. This episode of the Rabbit Hole Recap is brought to you by Unchained Capital. You freaks already know all about them. Our friends at Unchained are developing incredible solutions for Bitcoiners who are either looking not to sell their Bitcoin. Friends, don't let their Bitcoin sell Bitcoin. If you're not looking to sell your Bitcoin, Unchained Capital is there with their Bitcoin collateralized loans. You can use Bitcoin as collateral to get liquidity in the form of U.S. dollars. And as long as you're paying off that loan, you're able to keep your Bitcoin. On top of that, they have their Vault program, which is their multi-sig setup, which allows you to engage in a multi-sig quorum with Unchained, and they will be one of the keys in that quorum if you ever need them to sign to move funds. On top of that, they're working on badass open source tech, including Caravan, which will let you do that same multi-sig quorum without Unchained. They've open sourced their solution to this. On top of that, they're working on Slip39, Hermit, and a bunch of other stuff. Go to www.unchained-capital.com and check out our friends at Unchained today. And the www.unchained-capital.com. And I believe Parker Lewis actually recorded an episode with Stefan Lavera earlier this week to talk about Caravan.
And DeRuve was on Noted. You should listen to both of those. They were both really good.
Yes. Actually talking to Parker to come on and talk about the repo stuff, which we're going to talk about in this episode as well. This episode of Tales from the Crypt is also brought to you by our friends at the Cash App. You already know all about them. They've been helping us stack sats. Now they're helping us stack slivers of stonks. And on top of that, they have the Boost program, all right? As you know, Cash App is the simplest way to send and save money. And now, I already alluded to it, now they have the simplest way to grow your money with Cash App investing. Unlike investing tools that only let you buy entire shares of stock, Cash App's going to let you buy a sliver of a share, all right? We're stacking slivers of shares. This way, when your favorite company's stock is just a little too expensive, you can still own a piece with as little as $1, okay? And Cash App is directly connected to your bank account, so you're not going to have to wait 4 to 5 days for that transfer to come in, so you can get into those stocks, all right, or Bitcoin. So you can start investing today. Brokerage services are provided by Cash App Investing, a subsidiary of Square and member SIPC. As always, use the code STACKINGSATS when you're signing up. You're going to get $10. $10 is going to go to our good friends at Owls Lacrosse in Chicago. Charity very near and dear to our heart. Owls. Oh.
Fuck stocks, stack sats.
I agree with that sentiment too, but if you want stocks for any reason, the option is there. Optionality. Optionality is good. Not in all cases. Maybe in dating, like having too many options can be a little confusing, but that's another tangent for another day. And last but not least, our good friends at GiveWell. You got to give a shout out to them as well. Giving is hard when you donate. How do you know what a charity can actually accomplish with your money? What GiveWell does in practice, it's hard to know what charities are going to do with your money. So GiveWell spends 20,000 hours each year researching which charities can do the most with your money. They recommend a short list of the best charities they found and share them with donors like you. GiveWell's recommendations are free for anyone to use, and they don't take a cut of your donation. Again, they don't take a cut of your donation. Learn how much good your donation can do by visiting givewell.org/TFTC. That's givewell.org/TFTC. They accept traditional payment methods as well as Bitcoin. So if you're looking for tax beneficial donations at the end of the year here. Go to givewell.org/TFTC. First-time donors will have their donation matched up to $1,000 if they donate through givewell.org/TFTC.
And they recently got an endorsement from friend and freak Michael Hawaii.
Shout out to Michael Hawaii. He's been using GiveWell to donate nets to people in Africa to fend off mosquitoes with malaria.
Boss.
Yeah. Hey, we're all about giving back. Your giving back is important. Care about your fellow man.
Also, I'd just like to say that every time Parker speaks, I just want to market by Bitcoin.
He does have that.
Just wanted to add that.
He does that have that effect on people. He's very eloquent and to the point. He understands Bitcoin. And actually, shout out to Unchained too. And maybe we'll start with this. I want to disclosure their sponsor. They brought on Will Cole to their team recently to be the head of product or the VP product. I don't know the exact title off the top of my head, but this is somebody coming from Stack Overflow who is working very closely with Joel Spolsky, who is a software legend, and Stack Overflow is a very highly vaunted website within the software development world. And so having somebody product focus coming from that world into the Bitcoin world is very positive to see.
We spoke about that last week, but always worth repeating.
Oh, did we?
Yeah. Huge hire. Congratulations.
Sorry about that.
And the Unchained team.
Forget that. I'm getting a little forgetful here.
It's good. It just reinforces it in the minds of the freaks.
Yeah, it's just true.
It's a good hire.
Yeah, it was a good hire. Good hire. That was some good news. This week, it seems like nobody can find much to talk about except for throwing shit at each other.
Well, it was definitely a slow news week. This was like probably one of the slowest news weeks we've had. I mean, it's the holidays, right? I think the holidays, news is in general a lot slower. And then it's the bear market combined with that. So people are extra salty.
Yes, the big event that people are extra salty about in the last couple of days is the banning of Crypto Deleted, which was an account that it was a bot that would take snapshots of people on its list, screenshots of tweets that were sent by people on the bot's list. And if they deleted those tweets, they would share the screenshots basically to keep the tweets in the public sphere.
They were only shared after they were deleted.
Yes. Yeah. And apparently the owner of the bot started exercising some editorial what's the word I'm looking for?
He was just tweeting from it. Mr. Chach runs the account.
Yeah.
Awesome dude. And he would tweet from it every once in a while. I don't know if that's where like the controversy came from. That's just used as like a scapegoat.
Yeah. A lot of people haven't liked the account. For full disclosure, I love the account. I have it on my Bitcoin list, and I think it's just a great, it's funny to see what people delete.
People who delete tweets often hate the account, right? Like, it makes sense that they would hate it, you know? And then they wanted to be spoil sports and try and get it banned. And it did get banned. I mean, but people have been trying to get it banned pretty much ever since it existed. Like, there's been so many cases of people who've gotten added to that bot that just freaked the fuck out.
Yeah.
And this latest time it was Lop who freaked out. And probably some of his supporters and probably a bunch of people that already hated Crypto Deleted all jumped on it at the same time and did the mass reporting thing, which you've seen happen so many times on Twitter. And then when you have the mass reporting, the account gets banned. So hopefully it comes back. A lot of times in these cases, we see it come back within a couple of days. He did move it to Telegram for now. So there is a Telegram channel. We're going to link it in the show notes. It's t.me/crypto_deleted. It's actually great in the Telegram channel. It's easy to search. Telegram channels are like super easy to search. And it's got all the photos there from when they deleted. And I guess let's just go into the fact that, like, why is a bot like this so useful? And it's because, especially during the 2017 run, is you have these frauds and these scammers. They'll post a bunch of tweets and then they don't stand behind them. They frequently delete them if they're wrong about something or they want to cover it up, but they leave the ones up that, you know, were right or show them in a better light or stuff like that. And they do it chronically.
No, I wish I was taking screenshots in the fashion that Crypto Deleted does, because the years-long thread that I've been building that we talked about last week, a few of the tweets in that thread have been deleted, one of which was Vitalik that Crypto Deleted actually caught, basically saying that research for Layer 2 is finished and like everything we got started at the beginning of 2020. That tweet was deleted, and It's a big hole in that thread. It was
yeah, it's super frustrating, especially when you go back to replies and stuff, and just like whole threads are broken up by people who've deleted their tweets. Yeah, it's not everyone who deletes their tweets is a scammer, but pretty much all scammers delete their tweets, right? So like, if you do chronically delete your tweets and you know you mean well, you are providing some cover to the practice, is my feeling. And if it's in the public domain, then like people should be able to archive it, and I support that.
Yes, I believe that in the grand scheme of things, if you take a step back, 30,000 foot view, if you will, we will be looking back during the next bear market, explaining to newcomers, oh my God, during the last bear market, things got so heated. We got so pissed off at each other. We got to such a crabs in a bucket scenario that we bitched about some Twitter bot that posted deleted tweets.
I mean,
tweets.
Last bear market was worse. There was like so much other shit going on.
More suicide hotlines last night.
We had the suicide hotlines. We had the block size debate, which got like super, super toxic. People wanted to raise the block size. We had Hearn's rage quit. We had Ethereum launching, and they had like huge Bitcoin bags that they were selling. It got pretty fucking salty back then too. So I think it's just going to get salty every time. And I think for most people, their first one's going to be the hardest. And then after that, it gets easier. Like it's just a relative thing, right?
Yeah. Once you've been through it before, it's like, I've seen this shit before. Like, everybody getting pissed off on Twitter. I've felt this before.
Unfortunately, that wasn't the only drama on Twitter this week. But before we do that, I just want to cover this because I like front loading disclosures. We have shilled HoneyMiner in the past on this podcast. HoneyMiner lets you mine with your regular computer, and it mines the most profitable shitcoin and then auto dumps it for sats, which is like a pretty cool concept.
We have Shield and we have paid Shield for them. They have bought ads on this podcast.
So they recently got purchased by Core Scientific like a month ago, 2 months ago. And since then, shit has been like kind of sketchy, strange coming out of that company.
Apparently, they were withholding affiliate link funds from users.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, whatever, but they've also been acting sketchy in a bunch of other ways, just in general, just like general sketchiness. It's a custodial service. Like, if you have any sats with them, like, consider withdrawing it, consider uninstalling the app. You know, not your keys, not your coins, just like a general whatever. It doesn't seem like anyone's reporting issues with withdrawals except a couple of the affiliate people who had some questionable tactics to begin with. But like in general, it's just another reminder that with these custodial services, not your keys, not your coins. And if you are in that situation for whatever trade-off that, you know, benefit you get out of it, you have to keep an extra eye on them. So if they start acting funny, you should, you know, be extra aware of how much you're keeping on a service like that.
And delayed or restricted withdrawals is one of the strongest alarms that can go off.
Yeah. And like poor PR and communication, stuff like that.
Yes, yes. And circle back to our conversation about crypto deleted and the drama there. Before we get into the next piece of drama, I think we should split up the drama with a segue into the announcement that Jack made yesterday.
Happy news. We'll do happy news, drama, happy news.
Well, because I think this particular happy news, it's one particular, two.
We only notice it because you say it.
It really relates to the crypto deleted thing. So Jack announced that Twitter is going to fund, similar to what Square Crypto is doing with Bitcoin Core developers, they're going to do something similar to people who are working on open source social media protocols. I don't know exactly what that is, but I imagine the tone of the thread to me at least sort of confirmed what I thought Jack was trying to allude to when we spoke in early March or February, whenever that was, and that like he didn't like that Twitter had turned into a client that he had to control. He was very nostalgic about the days in which Twitter felt like a protocol. And it seems like this announcement yesterday is him trying to act on that nostalgia, and basically, to me at least, this is the way I read it, cede control, or at least develop social media protocols where Twitter doesn't have to have control of the messages being sent, and you can build different clients on top of this messaging protocol where users can create their own filters and ways they can interact with each other.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of vague, but it was absolutely great to see. But I have a similar take. Like, it basically seemed like he was describing something similar to Mastodon, where you have, like, a federated model, where you have this open source protocol, and then you have a bunch of different servers running, these federated servers that have their own little bubbles within them that are moderated or centralized individually, but then they all can interact across across servers. So if you're in one server, if you're in the Twitter server versus some other server, you can still communicate between the two servers, but you have different siloed experiences in the individual ones. And it almost seemed like you wanted to take it a step further, where, like, in the Mastodon model right now, you can't move your identity between federated servers. It's like you have the ability to like relatively easily opt out and still not lose the network effect, but you have to start fresh if you move servers. It seems like he would want, and that makes sense to me, that you'd be able to move your identity across these different like entry points to the protocol.
And who and that's what makes like WebLN and those ideas fascinating too. If you can incorporate Bitcoin and Lightning nodes into it and have like a quasi digital passport in which your reputation follows you with this economic value. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'm talking bullshit right now, just spitting ideas. But if these open protocols merge together, it's going to be very interesting to see the creativity that's enabled.
I mean, one of the things that I think is such a waste of fucking time is arguing over like which accounts should be banned or censored and stuff like that, because I really think that the path we're going we'll see going forward is going to be this path where you can't ban people even if you want to. Like, the speech is protected, like, at the tech level. And, like, once you hit that point, it becomes irrelevant. Like, morals, you know, there's no moral compass there of who gets to speak and who doesn't get to speak. And if people do things that are considered illegal in a specific country, then, like, you just do good old-fashioned police work and you take them.
Yeah, no, that was a debate. I got into somebody around this topic, somebody who's actually advocating for centralized social media because of, do we really want to open up Pandora's box of this free data sharing via like node and server structures where like bad actors like child pornographers and stuff sharing data between servers and stuff like that. Is that traveling through? Are we in possession of that at any point? Like, is that a box you want to open? But I tend to, and this is similar pushback that I gave as well. So you're gonna have to solve these problems in meat space and win the battle of ideas and the battle of the minds in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, Gab has just gone to war on porn in the last week too. I forgot about that. We didn't even have that on the list.
Yeah.
Just porn in general. They want to ban it from their whole platform.
Porn. They have their views, man. They think it's acidic.
It's just ironic from a free speech company.
Yeah, it's...
But as they said, which is pretty cool, is they are using... They're a fork of Mastodon. So, you know, if you don't like it, you can fork it. And you can have your own server. And you can play by your own rules. And that's, you know, I think really where we want to see all this stuff go. Encryption and you know... But in terms of public broadcast, encryption doesn't matter. But using encryption and these distributed networks to basically protect speech, like at the protocol level.
Yeah, no, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And again, I could see it in Jack Dorsey's eyes when I interviewed him. Like the nostalgia he felt for, again, Twitter being more like a protocol than an app. It seems like he's acting on that. And it's the announcement for however you will, but it seems to me at least that it's in earnest effort to open up things.
One thing I thought was funny was when he said he was going to live in Africa for a few months, the Twitter stock dumped. And then when he said he was going to transition Twitter into like a distributed open, you know, one client on a distributed open protocol, the stock pumped, which is interesting. Markets are weird.
Yeah, the algos really don't know how to react to this news, it would seem.
But it's good to see.
Yeah.
Well played, Jack.
Yes. Back to drama.
Nice and optimistic. Next piece of drama was Jill Carlson's censorship resistance paper. Now, I guess like it was a post in CoinDesk. So as usual for Bitcoin Twitter, there was seeming like everyone lost any kind of nuance whatsoever
right?
when debating this topic, huh?
Yeah, no. So basically the crux of the debate is whether or not Bitcoin is servicing the correct use cases at this given point in time. Is it serving the use cases that it set out to? And I wrote a Ben about it yesterday. And I wasn't calling Jill out.
Who were you calling out?
Wasn't calling Jill out personally. I was calling out Joe Weisenthal because he's been he's been on this tip for a while that Bitcoiners aren't hardcore like cypherpunks anymore. And it's terrible framing because it could serve both use cases at the same time. And yes, it may be serving one use case over another at this given point in time, but it doesn't negate Bitcoin from serving the legal use cases as well.
But so like Jill's whole point was that the whole reason we make this trade-off with favoring distribution, favoring decentralization, is for censorship resistance. Otherwise, you can just use a regular ledger. You can use like Venmo or something like that that's just, you know, centralized and you can pay anyone who's allowed to be paid, and it's relatively cheap transactions, way cheaper than a decentralized system. So the whole reason we do that is for censorship resistance. So I almost think it was more damning on like the Ethereum altcoin side, because they have so many projects that are just super naive that don't expect a state actor to come in and squash them, right?
Yeah, what was it? Uniswap or Compound that just got forced to cut off some countries or something like that?
It was Uniswap's, but Uniswap's like centralized front end that had to do it.
Yes, it's a smart contract.
But like if you interact, there's like a bunch of nuance to that too. But yeah, anyway, but like stuff like Maker just, it came out that like if 51% of Maker holders, this was already known, but it got re-released in more in depth. 51% of Maker holders collude. They can steal like all of the ETH that is in DAI contracts. The ETH that backs the DAI so-called stablecoin.
And A16Z has a crazy amount of Maker.
Right. For their issue, it's not, they don't really consider that an issue because they all know like the 10 people in the room that control the 51%. So they trust each other. But the thing is, the US government knows that too, right? So like if you're running this whole platform and you're saying like it's censorship resistant, but you're really just relying on your government not cracking down on you, like that's a little bit ridiculous. It's naive and you're just asking for fucking trouble. So like I actually completely agree with Jill's post. I just don't think that it had anything to do with Bitcoin.
I do as well. No, that's... Yeah,
and she never actually used the word Bitcoin. She kept saying cryptocurrency. And then I would push back on Joe, and I would say to Joe that there's plenty of us that talk about this all the fucking time. And then I'd push back on all the other motherfuckers who are arguing about it, that you need both. It's not like...
Yeah, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, you need the value. Otherwise, you have no value to send, right? Because we need the bearer token. So the token has to accrue value. Bitcoin has to accrue value. It needs to have a store value property. And you need to be able to spend it when you want to spend it. Like that's like the two keys of good money, and they go hand in hand. They don't compete with each other. I don't think the people that say that the majority of people on like Bitcoin Twitter like only care about like hodling and like never spending is like, you lack nuance, bro. Like that's obviously not the case. Just because we're saving good money now to spend later doesn't, you know, negate that.
No, not at all. And it's all about the framing. Don't let these people put you in this frame of it has to be this way or that way. It's just, again, there's more nuance to it. It right now, Bitcoin, to me at least, makes more sense that there are more hodlers, fanatics, and speculators, people trading the high volatility. Over time, as the fanatics stay fanatical and keep hodling and volatility keeps getting lower, it'll shift from saving and speculation to saving and spending with little speculation. Like, it's just going to take time.
And it'll be different for different people depending on their situation, like how much Bitcoin like is a percentage of their overall holdings, right? Like if you're getting paid in Bitcoin, like you're way more likely to spend it, right? Because you're not getting additional fiat. You're not receiving fiat. The majority of your money is in Bitcoin.
And then on top of that, like even there are even tools that are very cypherpunk that hodlers are using, like Jeff Vandrew's Keykeeper IRA that we were just talking about. Like it's a financial product, but you hold all the keys in a multisig that you control. Like that's pretty cypherpunk. And it's using it as a hodling Even though they know you have that Bitcoin, you still have control over it at the end of the day.
Government.
Yeah, but if anything ever goes to shit, like the government's not holding that, you are. You can just move it.
It's like at least semi cyberpunk. Yeah. I mean, I think the other issue, and she either did it intentionally or CoinDesk did it intentionally to drive clicks and drama, which I think like it triggered a lot of people. Was like in the headline, it said, you know, cryptocurrencies are breaking laws. And like Joe also jumped on that bandwagon, you know, like why don't we say it more often? Like Bitcoin's also used for not breaking laws. Why are we going to constantly talk about the exact narrative that regulators want to use against us, framing Bitcoin as a criminal activity? There's a reason why we've settled on the term censorship resistance, because
it's all relative. What's illegal in one country may not be illegal in another. And
also, people know censorship is bad, right? And there's also it harks back to our constitution, right? That you have this free speech, right? So censorship is speech, and it's a very nice framing for Bitcoin, especially in the United States.
Yeah, and let's be clear here. Bitcoin does not serve the use cases of those looking to interact in transactions that would otherwise be censored. And Bitcoin does censor those transactions, and Bitcoin has failed. Like, let's be upfront about that. Nobody's hiding that. Like, nobody's saying if people trying to make transactions that would otherwise be censored have those transactions censored on the Bitcoin network, that we can somehow have it survive into perpetuity and it's okay. I would say Bitcoin has failed if that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be able to spend it. If you can't spend it, then it's not money.
Yes.
But Bitcoin has been succeeding on that front as well as the store of value front. It's been succeeding on both fronts. My point there was just that I feel like let's not pretend we live in this like super, you know,
black and white,
like, yeah, like, or like perfect world where there is no political framing. Like, there needs to be some calculated political framing, like, especially if you're like a more public Bitcoiner, or, you know, like you can't be just going out there. Like, you can't do like the Virgil type of thing where you go to North Korea and you like
say, hey,
potentially allegedly send an Ethereum transaction between North and South Korea, breaking sanctions.
Yeah. Calculated.
Yeah, calculated.
Yeah.
Yeah, because censorship resistance is a great term. It means exactly what it should mean, and it's framed really nice.
Yeah. And let's just talk about some of the use cases it services. Right now in America, it is good for marijuana dealers who cannot send money to banks because their banks are hooked up to the federal government.
Well, not dealers, like dispensary.
Dispensary,
owners.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Still
the
stuck
legal up. Businesses.
Yes, the legal businesses. and even the illegal ones. Bitcoin can serve them too, but.
Framing, Marty, framing.
But not framing. Let's bring it back to framing. The war on drugs here in America, I think most of us, or most of you listening, most of you freaks out there listening to this podcast will agree that it is an abject and complete failure 100 years in. And consensus in America is coming more around to the drug war has failed. And that is something that is illegal in the States now, but most people believe shouldn't be. So people should be able to make those transactions. Bitcoin enables that. And that's something that in the future may not be illegal and probably won't be illegal. But if we didn't have Bitcoin, these people won't. I mean, not that Bitcoin is their only option and the only option that they're falling on, but it is an option that they have.
Yeah, I mean, a perfect example was your interview with Matt Alberg the other day. Like, that was lawful remittance, like people just trying to get money back to their families so that they can eat. And it's blocked in the current system or made prohibitively expensive, right? That's a form of censorship. You know, you have, I mean, I don't know of particular cases, right? But you can just imagine so many situations where you have an authoritarian government coming down on you, and being able to freely move your money is not only moral, but necessary, and it's a huge objective of Bitcoin. That's the whole point of Bitcoin.
Yeah, it works for hodlers and those in need to make transactions that would be censored in the traditional financial tunnels.
And I feel like everyone helps each other, you know, like this idea that, and you touched on it in the bend, and this idea that that people that right now are just saving Bitcoin, that they're just, you know, they're buying Bitcoin, they're stacking sats and they're saving it and they're hodling it, aren't like contributing to the network, or they're freeloaders or something like that. Like, that value increase that they're bringing into the system helps everyone and increases liquidity. Yeah, just increases adoption, pays miners more.
Keeps interest around the protocol, so people keep building the tools so that these people can make these transactions that we're talking about. It's don't hate on your fellow Bitcoiner. Bitcoin is for everybody.
Damn right it is.
Yeah. And people are not coin joining as much as they should be.
Did you see this? I updated my chart.
Yeah. Looks like...
it could be higher.
Could be higher. Looks like it's gone down too in the last month.
Yeah.
October was a bad month.
It's a little bit cyclical.
Or November was a bad month.
It's kind of trending up. Wasabi's kind of flatlined a bit.
Yeah. So let's jump into it. What are you pulling these stats from again? Let's go over the data that we're looking at.
So Wasabi's using a fixed fee address. So you can just go to the Wasabi address and see how many rounds have taken place. Wasabi rounds go by when 100 participants join, or every 2 hours, whichever happens first. And how many rounds do I have there for the month of November?
For Wasabi?
Yeah.
546.
And they're 10 million sats per round. So each UTXO, because we don't have confidential transaction, each UTXO has to be the same size. So with Wasabi, that size is either 0.1 or higher, because sometimes they'll do higher mixed combinations on like smaller anon sets. So then with Samurai has the smaller round sizes. They have only 5 participants per cycle, and they have differing amounts. They have 3 different pools. They have the 1 million sats pool, they have the 50 million and the 5 million. So basically they lined up their pools around Wasabi's above and below.
Yeah, and they had all in 998 what is this, rounds?
Yeah, it's all based on rounds.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very basic analysis, but just a basic looking at it. It'd be a lot more difficult for me to do it by actual amount of Bitcoin, because Wasabi rounds vary so much in size. But it is, you know, it's just a way to look at it. That's why I think it's interesting to look at it from the different pools. Because that's not shared liquidity either among Samurai, right? Those pools are all distinct. So you almost like look at it as like 4 different products. You have like the Wasabi pool, and then you have Samurai 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
So the round sizes is a good way to compare it to itself, right? So like to just look at the 1 million pool size and be like, okay, these rounds have always stayed constant, right?
From month to month.
And like, let's see month to month how much that usage is. That's kind of what I'm looking at. Obviously, the more people that coin join, the better, because the whole concept of coin join is like hiding in the crowd. So we want to see that number go up, especially if you agree with Jill's piece, right?
Right. And the potential for that number to go up was, this isn't on the list, we debated whether or not we're going to talk about it because it just relates to this. To do these coin joins, you need to send to a BEC32 address, and BitMEX just enabled BEC32 withdrawals for their customers. So if any of you assholes are trading on BitMEX out there and looking to clean your coins, or not clean them, to coin join your...
Framing, Marty.
I know. Are looking to...
If you want to use Bitcoin privately.
If you want to use Bitcoin privately after you trade on BitMEX, you can do that now by sending it straight to Wasabi or Samurai.
Exactly. Hopefully next thing they'll do is stop reusing fucking deposit addresses.
That would be huge.
Someone said to me the other day, they were like, aren't you afraid that exchanges will start blocking transactions with CoinJoin deposits, with CoinJoin history in them? Because, you know, like, where do they draw the line? Are they going to do it eight hops ago, 10 hops ago? At what point does it no longer necessarily was you doing the CoinJoin? And I said to them, I was like, well, what happens if they decide to block coins with the BitMEX history? Right, like that's arguably way more coins. I mean, I would bet on it being way more coins. I've not done any kind of math there. I think we'd be in a good spot if CoinJoin liquidity was as high as BitMEX volumes. But like, that'd be crazy, right? But that's way, that's if you're thinking about something like a CoinJoin ban being enforced at scale, like, why wouldn't they ban BitMEX? BitMEX isn't allowed in the United States. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah. I mean, maybe they'll try. We shall see.
Yeah, the point is, like, I just don't even think that that's, like, we have bigger concerns as Bitcoiners if that starts trying to be enforced at scale.
Yeah. Yeah. So be aware. CoinJoin has looked like it's flatlining a little bit. So if you are looking to use Bitcoin privately, think about it.
When you withdraw from BitMEX, do a CoinJoin now.
Yeah. And also, make sure you know what you're doing. Make sure you know the best practices. Matt included a good chart, infographic. What am I looking at here? The tips. There's some tips on the tweet that we'll share in the show notes on how to use each mixing service.
Yeah, I mean, there's
tips and concerns.
There's so many things that you can do wrong. There's so much nuance, and it's very difficult to use Bitcoin privately right now. It's one of the reasons I'm so bullish on Lightning, because I think it'll make it a lot easier to use Bitcoin privately. But it's important to realize that nothing here is 100%. There's a lot of pitfalls. You have to be very careful. But at the same time, like, I don't think that should scare people out of using CoinJoin, because the majority of people right now are already leaking tons and tons of fucking information, right? So in 99% of cases, like, even if you fuck shit up, like, you're in an improved position, and, you know, don't operate under the assumption that it's perfect, that you did it right, right? Operate on the assumption that you still fucked it up. But it's still an improvement. Like, it's not hard to improve the horrible privacy situation of the majority of Bitcoin users, right?
Yeah, but it's, you can only lead a horse to water, right?
No, because I get that a lot, like in my DMs and stuff, and like talking to Bitcoiners in person, where they're like, I've been overwhelmed and worried about trying it. I don't think I could do it, you know? And that's my response is, you know, like, you try it with a little bit of money, you know, like a small amount that you're willing to lose.
Try it on testnet.
The problem with testnet is it's different for testnet reasons, right? And, you know, like, the confirmations are not constant. The round sizes are smaller, stuff like that. And it kind of screws with people's understanding, I think. But for 99% of people, we can only go up from here in terms of privacy. And I think that's also an important thing to just keep in mind.
Yes, yes. We should be fighting to make Bitcoin more private. We talked about that last week. If you didn't catch that episode, go check that out. Speaking of privacy, Square Crypto gave a dope grant yesterday to somebody who's completely anonymous. ZMNSCPXJ is somebody who's been working on the Lightning Network, and Square Crypto gave out a grant to this Anon dev, and people are pumped. Apparently, this Anon is very good at what he or she is doing.
I was wondering how you're going to try and pronounce their name. But yeah, great dev, huge hustler, constantly working out there. And I just think it's really cool that, like, this wasn't possible. Well, first of all, it's cool that they actually did their work and put their work in to, like, get approval, because they're a public company. But it's pretty cool that, like, a company can provide a grant to a NIM without, like, knowing where they live, knowing their name and stuff like that. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was the crazy thing in the Twitter thread announcement. They only know the time zone, GMT plus 8. It could be in China, Brunei, Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore. We have no idea.
And not only that, like, you can't pay someone like that without Bitcoin, or at least before Bitcoin. Because now you could pay them in a shitcoin. But yeah, you couldn't do that before Bitcoin. That's pretty, it's powerful shit.
Yeah, so shout out to the team at Square Crypto for putting their necks out there. I mean, again, like you said, this is a public company making a pretty ballsy move. It's like, a lot of the comments in the thread are like, how the hell did you pull this off? Like, we'd like to do this, but so shout out to Square Crypto for pulling it off.
And then Rockstar did, like, a CZ tweet. He's like, better not ask this. Some things are better unsaid in this industry, right? For the sake of the industry. Fucking love that meme.
Yeah.
Did you see Rockstar was shilling his promo code to Bitblock Boom? And he says that if you use the promo code, you win drinks with us, him, and Rodolfo.
I did not see that, but I'm all in.
Yeah, use code Rockstar, Bitblock Boom.
Or TFTC.
Do you think Gary put the code yet for TFTC?
I don't know, Gary, if you're listening.
Try putting TFTC in first, and then if that doesn't work, you can put in Rockstar.
Is this?
And then we'll just take credit for all of Rockstar's.
Yeah, is this uncouth of us right now, taking somebody else's affiliate?
I don't know. I love Gary. I love Bitblock Boom. It's cool that Rockstar is going to be... He's going to have a whole technical track this time, so Rockstar is going to be speaking in that.
Yeah.
It's a good conference. It's a nice small conference in Texas in August. Consider going to it. It's a good time.
It's a small one. And
it's intimate.
Very intimate. So get tickets early if you're honestly thinking about it.
And there's going to be... He's actually doing a full live stream this time, supposedly, so it's going to be dope. Boss. So you can view from away.
So people don't have to read transcripts and get triggered?
Yeah, if you freaks remember, that was the conference where Bitstein had his famous famous presentation that triggered all of crypto Twitter before they even watched it, which is pretty amazing.
Yes, yes. Michael has a penchant for triggering people.
Should we go to the next piece of drama since we had a happy drama, happy drama, happy. Now we're back to the third piece of drama.
I don't know what drama you're
alluding to. The Bitsy token on Liquid.
Oh, my God. I haven't been following that too closely.
I mean, there's not really that much to follow. Blockstream has this federated sidechain called Liquid that basically uses a big-ass multisig to secure the system.
It's 11 of 15, I think.
I think it's out of 16 now. I think it's 12 out of 16.
Really?
But they keep adding to it, right? And the idea is to do... all the stuff that doesn't really need censorship resistance, the stuff like that people want to do on like Ripple and Ethereum and stuff like that. And then just you put it on this federated sidechain, you don't need a different token. It uses LBTC, which is Bitcoin held in that multisig. And you have like, it's like custodial, but it's an improvement on custodial, right? Because you have to have all these federated partners collude, and hopefully they're in all different countries and stuff like that. So one of the main use cases for it is something like Tether, where you have to trust Bitfinex and Tether not to actually have the money in the bank anyway. You know, trusting this 12 of 16 federation isn't really that, you know, big of a jump from that. And of course, all the other bullshit tokens that exist out there seem to be the target of Blockstream and to get them onto Liquid, right? And the big hot thing nowadays is to have these exchange tokens, which BNB led the way, where they like pretend like they're quasi equity by buying and burning their own token to drive it. And Bitsy is the latest exchange to add it. They added their own token. I think they're doing a $50 million ICO, and it's going to be like a 200 million total supply. And their projections are like fucking ridiculous. And they're launching it on Liquid. They're the first major. They're not even a major exchange. They're like the first relatively big liquid token to launch. So the first is fuck exchange tokens. Like everyone knows how I feel about BNB and Leo. They're centralized. You literally, not only do you have to trust them with actual, you know, the ledger and protecting your coins and not fucking you because they're centralized. You also have to trust their reported numbers. Like they're not audited or anything. Like when Binance says like, this is how much revenue we made. And people are like, oh, they made more than Deutsche Bank. Like no one knows like if Binance actually made that money, you're just taking their fucking word for it. And then last but not least, they have even increased regulatory risk over all these other tokens because they're exchanges. They handle fiat. This is, you know, one of the reasons why we always say here that proof of stake centralizing on exchanges is so bad because the exchanges are the easiest targets for regulation. And the same goes with the token. Like you can't cold storage Bitsy token or BNB token because it doesn't fucking matter how you store the coins if they can just change the ledger behind your back or freeze your account or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all very... I mean, I saw the Bitsy... and noticed that they're doing the ICO. I thought it was like a little fishy. And the relationships that exist between some people in Blockstream and Bitsy and all that drama too. We're not going to get into that. But yeah, I mean, it's nothing I would invest in.
It feels. I think people should be ashamed if they're promoting this to retail because it's just a bad investment or whatever. I think, but I also think it's fucking hilarious that basically like all these Ethereum people got triggered by it, and they're like calling out Blockstream for launching this ICO, but like facilitating an ICO on their platform, right? Because Blockstream isn't launching it; Bitsy is launching it. It's just on Liquid. And I guess in general, anyone can launch a token on Liquid. So it's what, you know, but it's just funny. Like, how can you get mad at them for that when that's literally what your platform, you know, was prioritized for all of 2017?
Yeah. And if you're out there making comparisons to Blockstream's raise and Ethereum's raise and launch, you got to really think your mental model of the space and stuff like that.
Yeah, and also it makes sense. Like, all these big exchange tokens, like BNB and shit, they're already centralized. Like, why pay Ethereum gas fees when you can just put them on this, you know, federated chain? Like, it makes a lot of sense to me why Liquid could be useful for... Even though I hate the tokens, it makes sense to me that the tokens are better suited long-term on a chain that, like, admits... how centralized it is, right? Like, takes certain trade-offs and does it accordingly.
Yes, yes. Speaking of gas prices, the hard fork was successful for Ethereum last week. It did screw up a few contracts, though.
Yeah, I mean, they just, like, called the 25 people that needed to update their nodes, and they were good.
Yeah. So be aware. Well, it really is a good case study in why hard forking may not be advantageous. Backwards compatibility may be advantageous, because if you hard fork and people aren't prepared, which is the case for a lot of Aragon contracts and a bunch of other...
Were those the contracts that broke?
I believe it was those and some others that the way their gas prices were coded into their smart contracts after the hard fork, there's just not enough gas to spend what's in the contract.
Oh, right. I saw that. Like, Gemini couldn't sweep their...
Yeah,
they're having their auto sweep bot or whatever contract call wasn't sweeping their hot wallet because it just was not paying enough gas.
Yeah, something like that.
But, like, I think they can just fix that, right?
Yeah. But for others, I think it was unfixable.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with hard forks is that if you can easily get the whole network to upgrade, then you can slip in attacks or vulnerabilities that older clients can't catch any longer because they're not part of the network. So it's a security vulnerability. That's why, like, Bitcoin doesn't have, like, an auto-update feature. Like, that's something that blows people's minds, right? But, like, when you... or using like malware bytes on your computer or some program and you have auto update, like, you don't think about it because, like, obviously you're trusting the company to update you correctly. Like, that's the relationship you have with that business. But with Bitcoin, like, one person or a group of people shouldn't be able to just force an upgrade down the whole network. Otherwise you can, it's like the easiest attack vector ever.
Don't trust Verify, freaks. Verify. Before you upgrade. Speaking of malicious attacks, what's going on with Tor? You were talking about this earlier. It didn't get much attention on Twitter, but it seems like a pretty big deal. Malicious relays on the Tor network?
It got like a decent amount of attention in like Tor Twitter. Tor users like in Bitcoin Twitter or crypto Twitter is like a still small subset, I feel like. And growing though, which is good to see. I mean, this is just an inherent problem with Tor's model. Tor is like semi-centralized in the way like their name servers work, and you can, it relies very much on like these block lists that go out to try and block malicious relays, because like anyone, there's no proof of work, right? So anyone can just run relays, and you can run thousands of relays. So it's been theorized for a long time that especially nation states have like the money to do it, America specifically, and like running all these relays. And the idea is that you try and, it's the same way you would try and track Lightning transactions, where you put enough nodes in the network where you see all the hops because they're going through you, or you see like enough hops that you can then make a guess. And this guy actually like wrote it up, and he's been tracking them. And that's the other thing, is like, what's a malicious relay, right? How do you decide what a malicious relay is? So this guy's been tracking like telltale signs of these different
yeah, so the one he's looking
actors.
Excuse me. The chart he's looking at is a graph that shows Sybil's guard capacity over time, about 3 years. And the guard capacity is going up pretty exponential.
So you have three nodes. You have guard nodes, mm-hmm. you have relay nodes, and you have exit nodes. The guard are like the entry nodes. They're where you come into the Tor network, right? So they see your IP, right? And then the relay nodes bounce around the relay nodes. And then if you're going to like an onion site, like a native Tor site, then you never leave. You just bounce around the relays and you go into the Tor site. But if you're going to just like Google.com or some non-Tor site, then you go out and exit nodes. So you have the three nodes, right? And like the famously, the one that in some countries can get you in trouble running is that exit node. This guy noticed a spike in both the guard nodes and the relay nodes. The reason the exit nodes have issues is because anyone whose traffic comes out of your exit node, you know, they might be going to bad sites and stuff like that, and that gets flagged as your IP going to it. But running a relay node is basically how you try and fend off this type of attack. The more people that run relay nodes, the more nodes the attacker has to run to try and pull off tracking. I mean, ideally, we should have a system that is, you know, has better incentives, that isn't prone to this kind of stuff to begin with.
Yeah. So what does this mean? Are they able to discern that they definitely are being tracked? Is it potential?
No, I think it's more of a... Well, first of all, with these types of things, it's like probability, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, which guard node did you come into? Which relays do you go to? But it's very much right now, like the way they're trying to fight it is whack-a-mole plus getting people to run nodes. We linked to a site, fastrelay.org, which makes it pretty easy to run your own relay node. I know BTC Pay has a flag where you can run a relay node directly in BTC Pay. And it uses a different Tor instance, so it's not linked to your onion address either, which is nice. But yeah, sustainable strategy, just playing whack-a-mole with like centralized block lists, and at the same time telling people to run nodes that they're obviously not directly compensated for. So it should be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, it'd be nice to get a proper successor to Tor.
Is the future of Tor in danger?
This is like the issue of Tor, just like the way it's built. This is the issue. Run a shit ton of malicious nodes under one entity and demask the whole network.
Yeah.
So yes and no, right? It's been doing pretty good up until this point. And keep in mind that even if you have one entity, even if that one entity compromises it, right, you're still protected from a bunch of other entities. But just as with all these other things with privacy, you can't ever operate that there's like a silver bullet or you're perfect. You should actually always be operating in the more paranoid sense and go to the extreme where like basically like if you're on the internet, it's compromised. You know, I'm trying my best to cover my whatever, but like I'm compromised.
Yeah.
And then proceed accordingly.
Yeah.
Crypt everything locally, offline.
Be aware. It's hard out there.
No one uses PGP. I've had a PGP fucking key listed for years. I actually changed it like 6 months ago, 7 months ago, and I didn't really go through. This is the problem with PGP. Like I lost the PGP key, and the only person who noticed was Stefan Lavera, which was dope. I'm glad he checked with me through a side channel, but. I have a PGP key listed. Everyone just DMs me in the clear, emails me in the clear. So there's still a lot of work to be done in that type of situation.
A lot of user mentality and flow to fix here. A lot of mental rewiring to do. If you want to protect your privacy in the digital age, and this is a good segue into two topics about data breaches, one at Amazon Ring and the other at a contractor that was working with Spring. So it looks like your data continues to be unsafe with third parties. Amazon Ring story came out on Vice earlier this week. Basically, Vice did a piece, reached out to hackers and are showing how hackers are breaking into Ring cameras and actually like talking to kids and stuff.
So Ring cameras are like those Amazon doorbells with the camera and the speaker and the microphone.
Yes.
That are connected to the internet, which already have a ton of privacy issues because Amazon has the information and police, it like easily partners into police programs where they're able to pull the information. But now, as we can see, it also...
You're getting raped every way. You got Amazon holding your data. You got them giving it to the cops so that they can spy on you. And then on top of that, they're not protecting it. And so weird people can get into your devices, spy on you, and talk to your children. This is the you're bringing these devices into your home. It is a personal choice.
Yeah, I mean, the talk to your children one is like the perfect news headline, right? That's how they ran with that one,
right?
But like they were like, I think they were like scoping out robberies and stuff like that, and it's not great, not great at all,
not ideal. And neither is what happened to the Sprint contractor. Actually, Amazon is part of this story as well. There was a Sprint contractor who was holding user data of Sprint users on an AWS cloud server without a password. So that was like something like 260,000 documents, which were not only Sprint customers, but Verizon, AT&T, and other networks, just because of the data share between these mobile companies. But yeah, so this contractor left all these bills with phone call information, payment information on an AWS server without a password, and it was basically free reign for hackers to come get that data for an extended period of time.
So first of all, I guess like the main way they get into the Ring one is by just, you know, hitting Amazon accounts, and just people have insecure passwords. So use a more, I mean, you shouldn't be using a Ring camera, but like use a better password on Amazon, people. And also Amazon, if they don't have two-factor, I don't think they have two-factor. They should have two-factor enabled, at least for the Ring product. As far as the Sprint thing, first of all, at least, you know, that not really, it's not Amazon's fault. The guy was just using AWS and didn't have password protected or anything.
But how's that even possible? Like AWS should make people password and 2FA.
Defaults are always important, reasonable defaults. But the other thing that's, but I guess you always have public-facing things out of AWS, right? Like people host websites on there and shit. But the other thing is, like, this guy didn't even work for Sprint. He was a contractor for Sprint, third-party contractor. And he had all this information on, like, AT&T customers and Verizon customers. And the whole point was to try and get those customers to switch to Sprint so he knew all their personal information. Like, that's so fucked from, like, so many different angles, right? Like, that... I don't know. It's like they just, everything in our society is just baked into just not being private at all. Just a leaky sieve.
It takes action. It takes action. Is this the world you want to live in, freaks? Ask yourself that question.
No, thank you.
And you have to do something personally. Act. Two more topics before we wrap up here. To more economic, geopolitical news. The war on cash continues. This week, in Greece and Italy, where two pretty draconian measures are being passed in Greece, Greeks will be hit with a hefty fine if they do not spend almost a third of their income electronically. Individuals that fail to meet that target will be hit with a 22% fine on the funds that don't meet the one-third of their income threshold. So they're trying to force people to transact digitally in Greece so that they can tax that. Greece notoriously has a very a culture of tax evasion. They don't like paying taxes there, but to try to solve that problem, the current Greek government is attempting to force people to transact digitally. In Italy, they're making all cash payments above 2,000 euros illegal in 2020, and that limit will drop to 1,000 euros in 2021. And anyone who refuses to accept credit cards is instantly going to get a $30 fine for each transaction they deny, plus a 4% fee on top of the refuted amount. So the war on cash is in full effect, especially in Greece and Italy right now. They're trying to get you to transact in these digital panopticons that they've erected for us, which is the current financial system.
The Greece one is doubly fucked. Because right. The Greece one is also forcing you to spend 30% of your income.
Right.
So it's not just banning cash. It's also forcing spending. Because if you don't spend 30% of your income electronically, you get a 22%
fine on
tax on the shortfall, basically.
Yeah.
That's fucked. This is like one of the, all these governments have been slowly moving to ban cash more and more. And in societies where they're not yet pushing these bans, the society itself is starting to frown on cash transactions and, you know, different stores and stuff around here. We even see like they're going cashless. And this is one of the reasons I'm, you know, most bullish on Bitcoin, is because I don't think these countries can help themselves, especially going into negative interest rate policies. They can't help themselves. Well, and one of the biggest arguments against Bitcoin being, you know, being able to use Bitcoin privately being an improvement is everyone says, oh, well, like cash is the best. And cash is the best in terms of privacy. But it won't even be an option in 10 years. So it's irrelevant.
Yeah. And I'm happy you mentioned NERP too, because another bank in Denmark instituted, I believe, 75 bips of negative interest rate policies on customers with more than 500,000 krona in Danish banks. And so they're hitting people from both sides, right? The low middle income classes that are just trying to get by and working paycheck to paycheck. If you don't spend a third of that paycheck electronically, they're going to take your money. And then if you do have money and you're looking to save it somewhere, they're going to get you on the other end. The rich folks who are just looking to park their wealth somewhere are just automatically getting taxed on that wealth. They're coming for our money. If this, all these signals aren't signs that something is terribly wrong. And this is a good segue into the last topic of the episode, which is the repo market mystery that seems to have been solved this week. It seems like things are terribly wrong within the international banking system. So with the repo market, in particular, we've been covering this since September. So if you freaks remember, in early September, there was a overnight spasm of repo rates. They spiked to, I believe, 10 to 15%, which basically signaled to the market that there was a liquidity crunch somewhere at the Fed window or between the banks and hedge funds trading between each other. And a month later, we came to find via Zero Hedge that JP Morgan, one of the world's biggest banks, has been embarking on a huge balance sheet restructuring this year, rotating out of cash and into longer term bonds. And so like early November, that news came to the market, and people are surmising that action by JP Morgan is what's creating the repo market sort of spasms, the liquidity crunch in those markets, in particular those money markets. And then earlier this week, Zero Hedge came out with another piece covering comments from the Bank of International Settlements, which is like the biggest top boss bank in the world. It's really the puppet master behind all the strings, behind all these central banks and stuff like that. And they came out and admitted what the source of demand for liquidity in the repo markets is, and it turns out that it's actually hedge funds looking to lever up. There are a bunch of hedge funds that are able to go to the Fed, so they would typically go to JP Morgan, it seems, or banks like them that were making similar balance restructuring throughout the year, and they would go to JP Morgan to get cash to service these levered positions in the market. And since JP Morgan rotated out of that cash and into longer term investments, that liquidity dried up and these hedge funds were forced to go to the Fed window and get liquidity there. So that's where all the repo demand, where a lot of it seems to be coming from. And these hedge funds are crazy levered up. Millennium, which is one of the biggest, is 5.25x levered. Citadel is 7.55x levered, and 0.72 is 5.48x levered. And the people at the Bank of International...
Insane.
Yeah, the people at the Bank of International Settlements said the Fed had to step in or they would have multiple LTCM-like instances. And LTCM, for you freaks who don't know, LTCM stands for Long-Term Capital Management. It was an infamous hedge fund that raised a bunch of money in the 90s based off a bunch of academic quants who built these algos that they said would never fail. They levered up a bunch and they failed pretty infamously in 98. They lost $3 billion in like 4 months. So the top bank in the world, representatives at that bank, are saying the Fed was facing multiple LTCM situations if they did not step in. So it seems like the hedge funds are the ones, the levered up hedge funds are the ones in need of liquidity right now. Whew, I'm ranting here. And it doesn't seem to be good.
Yeah, that is...
Sorry for that long-winded rant.
You did a good job.
I didn't breathe.
Trying to explain a complicated... I think a pretty complicated topic.
Yeah.
that I don't pretend to really understand. But the leverage is very interesting. It does not sound like a safe situation to be in.
Yeah, so the way the BIS's language was structured, it seems that these hedge funds needed to service their margin.
Otherwise they get liquidated.
Yeah,
right?
Otherwise
they
get liquidated.
Close the position.
Yeah, well, which is being liquidated or sell.
Well, like liquidate is like force close, right?
Yeah, well, if you... The problem with liquidation when you're that levered up is slippage. So you can only liquidate so much before price moves and you're fucked.
True. Yeah. Not great.
Not great
this
at all.
This is why we Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, be aware. Like, things are looking frothy. I said it in my thought of the week for Sat Standard last week was 2020 is going to be a hell of a year, freaks. Put your helmets on in every aspect. We got an election here in the States. We got trade wars heating up. We got things going on in the banking system. We got the Bitcoin halving. I'm going to roar into the 20s here, it seems like. Things are interesting in a good and a bad way. In some good ways, some bad ways.
It's interesting how the halvings always line up with U.S. presidential cycles, I think is interesting.
Right.
Like, that'll always be the case, unless, like, a lot of hash keeps coming online before difficulty retargeting.
Yeah.
By, like, a lot.
Yeah. Bitcoin Cash may miss out on the election cycles.
Yeah, they're 5,000 difficulty adjustment in the beginning where they tried to be parasitic to Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think they're 5,000 blocks ahead of us. So that'll be actually something to look forward.
Quasi pre-mine.
To something to look not forward to, but to pay attention to is when Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV have their halvings months before Bitcoin.
It'll be even cheaper to attack them.
Yes.
But they haven't been attacked yet, so...
Unless their price raises, which I'm not banking on at all.
Not going to hold my dreams. Dreams of a spectacular reorg that have yet to be seen. Did we have any shout-outs this week?
We did not. No shout-out love. But shout-out to you, freaks.
I have two Twitter shout-outs.
Get it.
That hit me with notifications in the last hour, so they get priority access. One guy, which is highly relevant, Mark DeBont on Twitter, sent a picture of his IKEA shopping today in the Netherlands that they don't accept cash. So the war on cash continues. The other shout out is Away Slice on Twitter, our boy Josh. He asked about the CoinJoin thing. Can you elaborate on your Wasabi concern of if a user doesn't remix, the Anon set will degrade? And what I mean by that is that the remixing is the most important part, right? Because if you think about it, when you're mixing with these people, if it's on, I guess on Samurai, it's like easier to visualize. But if you have five people in a mix and four of those people, the majority of those people are either one entity or they all do bad privacy techniques. So like you mix with 80 people, and like 60 of the people then send them to KYC exchanges so that they all get, you know, identified. And then 20 of them are being run by a bad entity that is just trying to fill up the mix pool to de-anonymize transactions. And then you're just the last one there. Like in that case, like you're going to, it'll be way easier to identify your transaction. So the more times you remix, it adds a substantially better like plausible deniability and difficulty of tracking it on the chain, right? Like I think that, did I do a good job explaining that?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Yeah,
that was for you, Josh.
Just hiding deeper in the mix. Got anything to riff on here?
Do you have anything?
No. I love this time of year in New York City.
The holidays?
Yeah. City's got a very special vibe.
I hate the cold.
Hate the cold.
Fuck the cold.
The vibes are high, though.
The nice, though, I've said this before, the one nice thing is I'm always wearing my face mask now.
Better be careful, man.
No, it's not suspicious because it's fucked up because I'm white and it's cold.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It's freezing out. All right, dude. Is that all we got this week?
Stay humble, stack sats.
Yeah, check out the website. Smash that subscribe button. Share. Yeah, buy a hat. Peace and love, freaks.